how you have achieved these savings. You've got some pretty impressive numbers here. It's one thing to see numbers on a piece of paper, but I wonder if you could just explain to me what you've done, what the changes have been, so that you've been able to realize these savings for the taxpayer.
I'd be happy to. First of all, I'd like to say that when you make changes in an organization, strategic and structural changes within an organization, many times positive change requires some very difficult and frankly sometimes heart-wrenching decisions to be made. I know that those decisions can affect employees, can affect their families, can affect their egos, can affect a lot of things. Believe me, I don't take those decisions lightly. They're not easy decisions to make. I didn't just take it this one afternoon in my office. I spent many, many days and hours thinking about it, trying to figure out the best solution to the problem. So when the decision was made to reorganize, the fact that that would affect employees' lives, I want everyone to know that it bothered me greatly, and it still does. That's not to say that I shouldn't make those decisions. I wasn't appointed to this position to just make easy decisions. I also wasn't appointed to this decision or this position, at least as I understood it, to sit behind the desk, make sure things continue to run smoothly the way they always had. I was appointed here to see if there were any changes that could be made in state government for the betterment of state government and for the taxpayers of this great state. And that's exactly what this change was. I've had 35 years of experience in commercial and industrial construction. As a result of that, I spent a lot of time. It's a big department. A lot of different things happen in our department. I had to spend a lot of time listening to people that had been there for many years just to get an idea of what our department actually did for this state and how diverse those services were. One of the areas that was fairly easy for me to get up to speed on was in the design and construction area. After having 35 years of experience, I understood that much better than a lot of the other areas, which I now understand, but it takes a little while to get up to speed on those areas. One of my concerns was not the performance of the employees. This had nothing to do with the performance of employees. This had to do with a system of managing our state construction projects that was, in my opinion, not productive, cumbersome, not producing the results that it should. And after further analysis and thinking, I decided the reorganization was in the best interest of the citizens and the state, and we made that decision and reorganized. It was a completely different method of managing our construction projects. It went from having actual state-employed project managers to having professional construction management firms hired to manage our construction projects, giving us a huge jump forward on not only flexible and scalable workload adjustments as we needed them, with our volume of construction as it goes up and down, but also with technology. We now have state-of-the-art technology, and whenever that technology changes, as you know, in private business, that usually changes pretty quickly. So all of that came along with the hiring of those professional construction management firms. So in essence, we went from being a construction entity with project managers to being a large owner, which is what we are, with owner's representatives dealing with our construction managers, who are now the project managers on our construction projects, and the departments themselves that have construction needs. We went from, we actually had 9 positions in that area, 7 of them were filled at the time of the reorganization. So we laid off 7 employees, and again, not performance related. I never even reviewed their performance. It had to do with a new way of doing business with the state. We laid off 7 of those individuals. We replaced them with actually didn't replace them. We hired three individuals as senior resource managers, and those senior resource managers dealt with the departments that had construction needs as liaisons between those departments and the Department of Administrative Services and the construction managers that we had hired. As a result of that, and the Legislative Services Agency did an actual issue review on that, we saved $730,000 in per year in operational costs. We, through claims and time, this last fiscal year, we saved over $915,000. We're projected this fiscal year to save over $1.5 million. And if that trend continues with the $376 million worth of construction we have right now, we'll have a savings of over $12 million.
Thank you for your answer, Director Carroll. I apologize for interrupting you, but the Senator's time is ended. And so, Representative Pettengill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Carroll, I had the opportunity to listen to the testimony yesterday from the four individuals, and there were some claims that rules, administrative rules, were not filed, or they were filed, but they weren't followed. And I want to go over at least the four that you know about and the other ones. What are they talking about? Was it at the grievance level, at the settlement level, at the record level? Do you have any idea if they made claims to you?
Representative Pettengill, I have no idea what they're referring to.
After reading their initial grievances and the appeals, initially it looked like the claims were that it was politically motivated, but yesterday Senator Garrett asked each one of them and they all said no. But one of the overriding claims through those four people were that the rules were not followed. So I pulled all the rules up, trying to see if I could see any discrepancy from what was in rules to what was not done. And I couldn't really find anything. So I was hoping you could help with that.
If I had any knowledge of somewhere where we were in non-compliance with the rules, I would certainly tell you, but I have no idea what that would be.
Another subject that came up was about a blacklist. Could you tell me what that is and what the future of that do not hire list?
Certainly. First of all, there is no blacklist. There is no do not hire list. There is no list. The state has no list. What the state does have is a procedure and a policy that, according to state law and code, that says this can happen in one of two ways, either through mutual agreement of management and the employee, or through specific criteria that's outlined in code that disqualifies an individual from future state employment. At that point, there's a code put on that individual's employee record. So if they apply for a job in state employment, that code comes up and notifies the hiring agency that they are disqualified from state employment. At that point, their application is returned to them along with a letter that gives them the procedures for an appeal if they feel they want to appeal that decision. So the fact, the word list, I don't know where that came from, but we have no list. And there's no way anybody could tell that they were coded as disqualified. Well, they could, but others could tell they were coded as disqualified unless they actually applied for another state position.
So the employee would be notified, their applications returned, and it would be completely transparent to them that they were coded, as you said, to not be eligible for state employment.
That's right, along with a letter that gives them the procedures they need to follow to appeal that decision.
Okay, would it be possible to see that letter that goes out?
Oh, sure, we could give you a copy of that.
Then in the settlement, you said that the four you were involved with were drafted by, helped, the PERB helped with the drafting of that. Do you know if that is consistent through all of these? That, so if it went through an appeal with the PERB board and there was an arbitrator or a mediator, that mediator would be the one drafting those?
The mediator would be the one that would be getting the two parties to agree to the terms and conditions of each agreement, yes.
Who are the mediators? Are they employees of, who are they?
They're appointed by PERB, and they're employees of, but they're administrative law judges, I believe, at PERB.
Chair Senator Peterson is next.
Thank you, Director Carroll. I think one of the basic questions Iowa taxpayers want to know is, why did he need confidentiality agreements? What was there to hide?
I'll speak to the four agreements that I was involved in, but that's enough. I can give you factual answers on the other ones. I wouldn't have any knowledge of the one. The reason we included them in these agreements is that we were negotiating with four different individuals towards settlement agreements, basically all within the same time frame. The practice of the confidentiality clauses was used in these instances so that one individual would not settle a claim and share that information with the other individuals that had not settled their claims yet, in an effort to mitigate the amount of money that the taxpayers were having to pay to settle these claims. That was the reason we included them.
And Carol Frank, in her testimony, said that Ryan Lamb contacted her attorney with $2,000 in hush money, asking if she would accept money, extra money to remain quiet. Where did he get the $2,000 authorization to offer that $2,000 to Ms. Frank?
I don't think that's a true statement, Senator.
So I'd have to ask her attorney for his documentation. You don't believe that was true? And you don't believe that they called back with another offer of $5,000 and she rejected the two?
I don't believe that's true either.
Tell me a little bit about when you were appointed by the governor. I know the governor has a goal of reducing government by 15%, and I just am curious as to what kind of communications that you have with the governor's office, what kind of communication you had with the governor's office as you were working through your reorganization plan that included the September 1st layoff.
I want to make sure I understand your question. The first part of that question was what kind of conversations I have with the governor's office prior to my appointment.
Well, when you were appointed, did the governor let you know it was his expectation to reduce government by 15%?
Yes.
Okay. And then did the governor's office play a role in your reorganization where employees were non-contract merit employees were removed from their jobs?
The only role that the governor's office would have played is in the normal procedure of approval of reduction in force plans. And that procedure is the department puts that reduction in force plan together. It goes to the Human Resources Department, who signs off on it. It comes to my desk. This is for all departments, by the way, not just the desk. Comes to my desk. I sign off on it. Goes to the Department of Management. They sign off on it. Goes to the Chief of Staff. They sign off on it. So they would have been aware of the reduction in force and the reasons for it and would have approved all of that. Yes.
Okay, so the Chief of Staff of the governor realized that you were going to be removing several non-contract merit employees from their positions with the state of Iowa because he would have to sign off on it on behalf of Governor Branstad?
Yes.
Correct. Okay. Okay. You know, you mentioned that you've saved the state a little over $700,000. Are you allowed to incorporate that savings each year in your budget amount? Isn't it only really a one-time expense? Once those jobs are off the books, then you can't continue to keep counting. It'd be like, you know, counting back to 1983 when we let go of a certain amount of people that we keep moving that savings for. It's like you've got your year and then you can't really count those dollars again. Am I correct in saying that?
Actually, I need just a bit of explanation here. Our department does not work like a lot of the other state departments. We do not receive, we receive a small appropriation for state accounting and some ceremonial services for the legislature. But the rest of our department works on a fee-for-service basis. Mm-hmm. So in reality, if we save money, our fees go down. So it saves everybody money. It doesn't just save our department money. It saves every department in the state money. So it operates more like a business than it does an appropriated state department, which is good for me because I understand that a little better than an appropriation. But at the same time, it's as if a company being competitive finds a competitive advantage, only we're required to find that competitive advantage. So as we reduce our costs, everybody in state, state government benefits.
So as you went through the reorganization process, you let go of several highly qualified people all in one area. Was there ever a decision, did you not believe that these people who had worked in state government for multiple years, that they wouldn't be able to adapt to a new business model? It appears to me that they were never brought into the reorganization process to see if that might be something that they would be interested in helping DAS move forward with a new style of business.
Well, as I mentioned before, Senator, decisions like this are never easy. It takes a lot of thought, particularly with strategic reorganization. All of these individuals were very qualified. I have no argument with that. I don't know of any performance issues. There may have been some, but that certainly wasn't the reason for the reduction in force or their layoff. The point behind it was their qualifications weren't the qualifications we needed for the new position. So it wasn't a matter of the fact that they were not qualified. Based on their resumes, based on their credentials, they're all very highly qualified individuals, but in our opinion, not qualified for the new positions and what we needed those new positions to do.
Mr. Woodley, it's my understanding from someone who testified last year that you had requested that they write the job description for their replacement. Is that accurate?
I'm not familiar with what you're referring to, but today is not.
Ken Thornton testified yesterday that he was told by you that you expected him to write the job job description for his replacement. Is that not true?
That is not true.
Can you explain what happened?
Mr. Thornton was a part of the layoff plan. Mr. Thornton was not employed in the design and construction area, but he was employed through the Capitol Complex maintenance area. And when I took my position here in state government, there were two different individuals that were kind of co-leading that area. And so the decision was made to have all reporting in that area go through one individual for more efficiency. And so Mr. Thornton was impacted by the layoff. But the accusation that she just indicated, I'm not aware of, and it certainly is not true.
Well, thank you for your clarification. Could you walk me through a little bit about the people who weren't hired to replace the group that was let go, but the three people who came in the day of the layoff as their first day of employment, it would be September 1st of 2011, I believe. At what point did you advertise for those positions?
Yeah, we...
Forgive the interruption. I want particularly the chair's question to be answered, but wanted to make you aware that we have reached our time. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, sir. Thank you. The question again, ma'am.
When did you advertise for those three positions that would be under your reorganization that would, for the seven who were let go, those three that would be coming in for the new style of the way you're doing business, when did you advertise for those positions?
Yes, ma'am. In working with human resources, those positions were not merit qualified, so there was not a public advertisement for those positions.
Those you were switching to at will for those positions?
Those positions were classified through human resources as at will.
Okay. And what about the interview process? Who was involved in the interview process for those people? You can come back to me.
Now you know the next question. We'll next call upon Representative Bodler to be followed by Senator Shinjohn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, thank you for appearing here. I want to focus on your confidential agreements, the settlement agreements, if you will. Can you run me through how you know, or how you were notified of how much to pay a person for signing these confidential agreements? And then how did you pay him? And is there bills and receipts? Follow me through the money.
Representative Bodler, there were the agreements were determined through a risk analysis for those employees. They had appealed their grievances to PIRB for a hearing. At that point, PIRB always requests or asks if the parties would be willing to go to mediation. It's our policy, our department's policy, to always agree to mediation. That's an attempt to try to settle things before going through a hearing. If an employee requests that, we'll do it. If PIRB requests that, we will go to mediation. So those agreements were crafted, the agreements we're talking about were crafted by a PIRB mediator. The amount of payments, we had done an analysis ahead of time and had what we call a walkaway number for each employee. That was based on an analysis of what our risk would be if we actually went to a hearing and lost every hearing, which you never know, so that was our risk analysis. The risk of that happening was $4.3 million. We then looked at each employee individually. We had a spreadsheet that said each individual, and we came up with an amount that we would not go over to settle these grievances. So we had a walkaway number. We never reached any of those walkaway numbers. And again, one of the reasons we had the confidentiality clauses was to keep us within those walkaway numbers if possible. So once those settlement agreements were signed, we then had a legal requirement to pay those employees the amounts on the face of the settlement agreement. As I mentioned in my opening statement, none of them qualified to go to the appeals board because they weren't back wages from a prior fiscal year. And we had money within our operating budget to satisfy those claims. So those claims were paid out of the operating areas where those individuals were laid off. And that's all traceable through the accounting system. You can tell exactly what organizational areas those monies were paid out of, and that's where they came from. So it wasn't like we had extra money, we had to go find money, we shifted money around. It's all very, if you want to go through the accounting records, it's all very clear and apparent what was done, why, and where those monies came from. The reason we had money in our operational budget to cover that was because we had $730,000 worth of a year of operational savings because of those strategic changes we had made. So we couldn't go to the appeal board and ask for additional money. We had enough money to satisfy those. Did that answer your question?
Pretty close. How much is in this walkaway account now?
There's no account. There's no account. It was simply an analysis we did so that in our minds, as we negotiated with each individual, we had a number that we knew we would not go beyond.
And this walkaway number was set up by individuals around the table or a computer?
It was done in an analysis by our labor relations team. An analysis of where their income was, what would happen if we lost the hearing and that sort of thing.
Who's on the team?
I believe, you know, I don't know. It was presented to me after it was done, so I can't say specifically who was on there. I could probably find out.
Anyone from the Attorney General's office?
No.
Okay. Okay.
No, it all would have been internal to that.
Okay. Second question is, in your opinion, reference these confidential settlement agreements, and I've read some of them, after they've been broken, is there any way that you or the AG's office will go after the dollars that were paid for the confidentiality?
Well,
because obviously they've been broken.
Representative, the confusion, and this is why I would strongly encourage this body to change the law. The confusion is with the Attorney General's office, as well as a lot of other entities within the state, as to how enforceable those clauses actually are. At the time these settlements were agreed to, the opinion of the Attorney General was that they were enforceable. Shortly after these agreements were signed, the Attorney General came out with a memo through Assistant Attorney General Julie Potter, and there had been some, it was either a court case or an arbitration, there was some precedent that had been set that they felt they were not enforceable. So the question was kind of put to rest, but at the time there was some question as to whether these clauses were actually enforceable. Not if they were lawful, there was nothing wrong with them with regard, they were lawful, but there was a question as to how enforceable they were. So I would be careful to say that we should hold anybody to those clauses. That would take someone with a much better legal background in mind than me.
Who would that be?
Probably the Attorney General's office.
Because we're talking close to $730,000 that we know of at this time?
These agreements and the total number, I know that's been out there, but I'm not really sure what that is.
Okay, so
we're out of time.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me, Representative Butler. The chair next calls upon Senator Shane John, to be followed by Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Carroll. I want to just continue on Senator Peterson's question for a moment before I do that. Who signed off on the reorganizational plan before you started the implementation?
I did.
No one else above you?
Other than the procedure I mentioned before, where it signed off, the reduction in force plan?
No, the whole reorganization.
Well, that's the result of that was the reduction in force plan.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was entirely your doing.
The structural reorganization and the idea of how to improve the organization was me and my team's idea. Mm-hmm. The approval of the reduction in force went through the process that I told you before, which started with human resources, came to my desk, I signed off on it, went to Department of Management, they signed off on it, and then went to the Chief of Staff, and they signed off on it. So that was their involvement in the restructuring.
I understand. And that was after the fact, though, that the decision has been made.
Right.
And then everybody signs off on that. And at that very top level, that was you.
That was me, yes, sir.
Okay. Okay, let's go to the interview process then. So we were told yesterday that there were people waiting to take the jobs of the folks that were laid off. How did you go about selecting these folks? What was their background? I mean, these were engineers and folks that you said you had very troubled. I mean, they were long-term state employees, laid off, and disrupted lives. Now, what were the qualifications of the people that you brought in, and who were these folks?
Actually, I wasn't involved in the hiring process, so I can't answer those specifically. And I do know that the ability to communicate between the departments and our construction managers was very, very high on the list of qualifications that was necessary, which would have required them to have some knowledge of construction and contracts and that sort of thing. Outside of that, I didn't see any of the resumes. I wasn't involved in the hiring process, and I don't really know why specific individuals were chosen.
Who did that?
I did that, sir.
Oh, well, I'll direct it to you.
Absolutely, yes.
Would. Please.
Yeah, the interview process took place before the layoff, as we were strategizing for the layoff for business purposes. We understood that it was very important for us to have a seamless transition from the previous methodology and delivery of our construction projects around the state to the direction we were going. At the time, it was about $430 million of construction projects happening in our state. That, in our region or in our state, let alone nationally, is a tremendously large dynamic portfolio. There was, in that $430 million of projects, there were approximately 125 projects on the books. So it was a very, very dynamic time. It was important for us, leading that process and representing taxpayers on those projects, is important to have a seamless transition. We were very concerned that we did not have a seamless transition if we didn't have a group of individuals, a small group of individuals, prepared to work within the new established business philosophy of representing projects the way that we currently do.
Do you have the names of these individuals?
The individuals that were hired?
Yes.
Certainly. Calvin Miller was one of them. Grant Carr was the other. And Evan Kagan was the third.
And what was their position then as they were hired?
All three of those had engineering and construction backgrounds and education and experience. Two worked for construction contractors, and one was a public service employee.
And what was their new title then that they were given?
Originally, the classification was an EO3 title when they began their duties as assigned by human resources.
And that's like a bureau chief?
It was believed to be a bureau chief at first. We later learned from human resources that it was more appropriately classified as a senior resource manager, and that better fit in with their job descriptions as personally representing agencies rather than representing construction projects. So that determination changed to senior resource manager at the advice of human resources.
So they did not have actually people underneath them. They were just brought in to supervise all these projects.
They were individual contributors as opposed to being supervisors, yes, sir.
And at what salary then as a bureau chief?
I'm not certain of the exact salary. I know that it was about the top of the range, which was in the $90,000 range.
And would that have been higher then than the people that they replaced?
It could have been higher than some of those individuals. I'm not certain. I know that to have anyone come in not in the median hiring range, a process takes place through human resources to observe what their qualifications and experiences are, and then that determination is set. And that's how that process was followed.
Thank you very much. And I guess I would just close that we lost a lot of institutional knowledge, so I would hope that those folks would be right on the ball when they stepped in with $450 million worth of projects hanging in the works.
Absolutely. We felt the exact same way, sir, and that was taken into full consideration during the process. Without question.
Thank you. Chair, next call on Representative County and then Senator Greiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here, Mayor Carroll.
Sure.
So to be clear, you believe no one broke the law?
I absolutely believe no one broke the law.
But we do agree that this is a practice that should be fixed by law.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to follow up with
this is much more, by the way.
So a couple comments. Senator Garrett had a very wise statement. We have the executive order, but what are we going to do going forward? And I know you weren't here last night regarding House Study Bill 684, but it did pass, and it passed after 8, after 11 o'clock at night. I know you didn't write the bill, nor are you pushing the bill, but you have advocated for the bill. How would Iowa be served better by your interpretation of that law?
Well,
it passed and going forward.
I have to tell you, the governor's executive order takes care of one piece of the confidentiality problem we have within the state. That piece, of course, is the confidentiality and non-disclosure clauses that says that people cannot talk about the terms and conditions of the agreement itself. What it doesn't take care of is the confidential information that is included on those settlement agreements having to do with why the grievance was filed in the first place and what the situation is around that particular employee. So when you go online and look at what's posted publicly, you'll see a lot of black lines on those settlement agreements that are redacted by the Attorney General's office because that's considered confidential information. A lot of that information has to do with performance issues. A lot of those performance issues can be, I think a lot of you would find quite shocking. At that point, if individuals are terminated or agree to leave state employment, it's very difficult for anyone else to tell why they left or whether they should or should not be rehired to a position because of that. Frankly, I don't think that's a good practice at all. I think it's, could be dangerous in some cases based on some of the things I've seen. And I would encourage very, very strongly that we make settlement agreements with the exception of very personal information like social security numbers, home addresses, telephone numbers, that sort of thing. Of course, I don't think that should be made public. But the reasons and the instances that occur because of those settlement agreements and terminations, I believe 100% should be made public.
So even with the governor's executive order, there will still be a lack of transparency to this unless something were to be done by the legislature.
Yes, Representative, that's evidenced by, please go online and look at those settlement agreements. It's evidenced by the amount of black on those agreements.
Got you. Thank you. I saw some quotes. I'm not sure if they're from the governor or from you. Do settlement agreements occur in the private sector?
Yes.
So how would you compare what has gone on in the public sector in our state compared with your experience in the private sector? And do you think they're good in the private sector? Did they serve the state well?
Good is in the eye of the beholder. They are definitely a very useful tool, and they're used by both parties typically as a tool to get to agreement. I know that the innuendo and the accusation is that it was to keep things secret. Well, it didn't keep much secret because all it took was a FOIA request to get those agreements. What it did do, what it was used as a tool to get to agreement, and it was a tool that the PERB mediator saw no problem with. The problem and the mistake I made was it does not comply with open, transparent government, or at least the appearance of open, transparent government. That was my mistake. I should have realized that. I should have not let them be included.
And one final question. Senator McCoy brought up the Attorney General and their involvement. You obviously have counsel that you've spoken of. I just want to just expand a little bit in terms of the Attorney General's involvement with your counsel and with you and how this transpired with your own experience.
Well, I have legal counsel within the department. Anytime we're putting an agreement like this together and there are issues that we have questions on with regard to either legality or state practice, state law, administrative rules, things that way, oftentimes we'll consult with the Attorney General's office, particularly on human resource issues. We have one specific individual down there that we talk to quite often on those sorts of things, and we'll get their advice. And like I said, the advice on these particular types of clauses at the time we included them was that they were perfectly legal. There was some question as to how enforceable they were. That question was cleared up, I believe it was like March the 20th of 2013. These settlement agreements were all settled prior to that date, and it was cleared up through some precedent-setting legal proceedings, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but Julie Potter then, if you ask the question, put out a memo with the opinion that they were not enforceable. Again, they were still legal, but the opinion was they were not enforceable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair calls on Senator Greiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning and welcome. I sat and listened to the testimony yesterday morning, and I have to say the testimony I'm hearing today is considerably different. I felt like yesterday their people offering testimony that truly had an axe to grind. And I want to congratulate you for coming here and being slow and methodical in your approach to answering the questions. I had a remarkable number of emails overnight after my constituents were reading the blogs and everything that was flowing out there in the media. And so I guess my first question has to do with going back, and I apologize to the rest of the committee. I can't remember which one of my colleagues asked the question about releasing people from their confidentiality clauses. And I believe you said you would be open to doing that. My request is if you're going to do that, if you could put forth some kind of a statement publicly on a website someplace, because the people I heard from, and they're just, you know, Joe Sixpack and Sally Sixpack out there in rural Iowa, their problem with the whole thing is if people violate the confidentiality clause, it becomes a matter of integrity. So if you're going to open it up, I beg you to publicly put a statement out there so everyone understands that whoever signed the confidentiality clause is released from it. Because right now, the people of Iowa believe that those who have violated, it becomes a matter of integrity, questionable integrity, and then everything those people say is subject to question. And I think it's important that everybody is playing by the same rules, because up to this point, I don't really think we have it all. Everybody's been playing by the same rules. So if you intend to release people from these confidentiality clauses, my request is that you would make a public statement, post it someplace where those of us who get questions can direct our constituents, okay, here's where it says everybody's released. Is that an unreasonable request?
I would make this statement with regard to that. I would be more than willing to release that. I'm not sure what my legal rights are to waive those. So I would need to check with the Attorney General's office. And provided that there's not a legal problem with any of that, I certainly wouldn't have a problem with doing that.
Very good.
Personally.
Yeah. Because what I heard yesterday and what I've heard today are really...
Excuse me, Senator. I'm sorry to interrupt you. What you have to realize is that if people decide that that's what they want, that confidentiality agreement goes away, and that's not always in the benefit of the employee. So those are things that need to be considered. And those are things that legally I don't know. I'd have to check on that. But if there's not a legal question, I would not have a problem.
Very good. Thank you. Another question that I have. Really, the assignment of this committee is to speak the truth and get it out there. And so far, we just had, it's like we're putting a puzzle together. But some of the pieces of that puzzle are still missing. And, you know, unless we, as a committee, really understand why some of these employees were terminated, we know that we heard that some of it was for matters of efficiency, and as a business person, I can certainly understand that. Had to make some of those tough decisions in my life as well. We only heard from four people yesterday. There's a lot more than four people have questions here. So I think I heard you respond to Representative Cowan that it would be beneficial, not just for the committee, but also for the people of Iowa, to open the confidentiality agreement, and really just total transparency, but redacting, of course, social security numbers. And I feel sorry for the guy whose name is John Miller and is a state employee, because there's probably at least a dozen of them. Surely there's a way that those folks who have fairly common names can, there can be some protection for them. Did I understand you to say that, in fact, we would all be better served if this information was out there?
In my opinion, we would all be better served.
I'll ask a couple of short questions in the House side of the rotation. One about the so-called blacklist. But Director Carroll, the first question I want to ask is regarding the oldest settlement agreement on record to the best of our awareness. And because your tenure started more recently, I'm not sure whether you would direct me to Mr. Woodley or Mr. Carlson, but please direct me to your executive that we could best answer, to the best we know in state government. When, what's the oldest settlement agreement? When was, how far back does this go?
Well, it goes back to 2004. Right. 2004, I believe, is the earliest one, which was part of the Vilsack administration. The electronic records are much easier to search than the paper records. We have searched through 45 boxes of settlement agreements from the Vilsack administration and have found, five settlement agreements with confidentiality clauses in them. So it goes back at least that far. We haven't gone back any further. And if you are truly watching out for the taxpayer dollars, I would encourage you not to go back any further. It's a very laborious, time-consuming thing to go through all of those paper documents. But it does go back that far. Paul corrected me. He's been going through the boxes. It's 2000 or 2001. It's the first one.
Either 2000 or 2001.
Yes.
Okay. That's different. That helps. I also appreciate your added comment about the laborious nature of that, because in this very room, when we got to the pretty close to the 11 o'clock hour, there were some good amendments being considered of should we go back to 1983 or perhaps the beginning of collective bargaining in 1973 as we look at this issue in the House bill that was passed by committee in this room last night. So that's helpful as we give consideration to that. 45 boxes was a laborious task, as you said.
If I might make a comment.
Yes, please.
If you do go back that far, frankly, the issue isn't going to change. So if you're interested in solving the issue, I think the issue's on the table, out in the open, and through the Executive Order 85, part of it's been dealt with. And with additional legislation, you can deal with a lot more, but we could go back as far as you want and come up with as many numbers as you want for whoever's administration you would like, but the issue will not change. So I might make that point. Thank you.
That's very helpful to many of us. We're given strong consideration of that last night. The issue of the blacklist, as it's referred to, two really quick questions on that. First, what is the proper way to describe this disqualification of employees, and is it actually a list? What's the proper term for that process?
If employees are terminated, that they can become classified as disqualified from further state employment through, like I said before, two ways, by mutual agreement. So through the mediation process or settlement process, an employee can agree that they will be disqualified from further state employment. That's one way. The other way is our specific criteria within the code that say if an employee is terminated, meet those specific criteria or multiple criteria, they shall be disqualified from further state employment. Like I said, at that point, they don't go on a list. their employee record simply gets coded as disqualified from further state employment. If they apply for a job with state government, that code tells the hiring agency that they are disqualified and not eligible for state employment. At that point, their application is sent back to them along with the letter, as I said before, with their right to appeal and the procedure to appeal that decision.
That helps. I'll quit referring to it as a list now that it's very clear. It is not a list. It's a code on that employee's file.
Right, the disqualification code.
The appeal process for that employee in that case, if it wasn't a mutual agreement, please walk me through briefly. I know you're going to share, because one of the legislators asked for a copy of that document later, and as you do that, sir, please send it to all members of House and Senate on the documents to be forwarded.
Sure.
The appeal process from the employee perspective, how does that work? As I receive the letter, please just describe for us how they can appeal, whether their file is coded in this fashion.
I can't answer that question for you because I don't know the specific steps. I know there's a letter that goes, Human Resources handles that, and I can't answer that specifically. But when the letter comes back to you, I'm sure it will be very clear and specific as to what those steps are, but I don't know what they are.
Well, my buzzer just went off, so I got to quit. So we're now calling on Chair Peterson.
Thank you. I'm going to go back to your math on saving the state money. Your equation, I believe, is just part of the equation because you start out with you've laid off 7 long-term merit employees, and in their place you've hired 3. And then you've also entered into contracts with construction management companies that would then fulfill the work that was being done by those 7 people.
Correct.
Could you explain to me, I've been told that the RFP process was a very small RFP process for these construction management companies to come in. Who issued the RFP? Could we get a copy of that? And then what are the names of the companies that you hired to do the work of these 7 employees? And how much money have we paid to those companies since these 7 people have lost their positions with the state?
Certainly. The RFP process would have been handled through the procurement enterprise. They would have issued the RFP and received responses to that. At that point, those responses would have been scored. It's the normal procedure whenever we go out to procure services. It would have been scored, and then a number of those individuals would have been called in for an interview based on their technical scoring and their pricing. And then firms would have been selected after that point. I think there were 6 firms that were selected out of that. I'll try to name all of them. I know Ryan Companies was one of them. J.E. Dunn was one of them. DCI was one of them. The White's Company was one of them.
Story Construction?
Story Construction was one of them. GTG was the other one. So those were the 6 that were originally selected. As far as the cost of their services compared to what we were doing before, again, in the Legislative Services Agency issue review, they show that the cost of using these construction managers was 1.2% less per volume than using state employees. We do on the average about $60 million worth of construction a year. So 1.2% of $60 million was actually a savings of $720,000. That number never showed up in the issue review, but the percentage of cost did. So the actual cost was 1.2% less on volume than it did before we made the change.
So did the Legislative Services Agency go through to see the amount of money that was being spent with each of these contractors?
I understand it, yes. Okay. That was all part of the issue review.
Okay. The confidentiality agreements that were signed by people that were part of the layoff, explain to me the rationale in also requiring people who chose retirement to also sign confidentiality agreements when they took forced retirement. How many forced retirees were requested to sign confidentiality agreements? Who made that decision, and why were we asking forced retirees to sign confidentiality agreements, and where did the language come from?
I don't have the answer to those questions, but we'll certainly get them for you. I'm not involved in that process anymore.
So you wouldn't be the person signing off on the confidentiality agreements for the forced retirees as part of, under your tenure?
Yeah. If it had to do with retirement and sick leave and all of that, those are I don't get involved.
Talk to me a little bit about your relationship with the governor's office. It seems like, I know he said he does not like to micromanage. Give me just an idea of what type of communications do you have with the governor? What types of issues does he care about going on in Department of Administrative Services?
Well, one thing I did find out is he cares very greatly about confidentiality clauses and settlement agreements. That was a kind of a one-way communication, frankly, and I found that out very quickly and very definitely. He doesn't micromanage, frankly, and I don't work probably at my best under a micromanaged situation. Like I said, I have 35 years of experience in the construction industry and also in the business itself. Construction is a business, as some of you may know. And as a result, he relies on my judgment, I'm assuming other department directors' judgments also, and our abilities and our experience to make the right decisions to improve state government. He expects to know when issues come up that he needs to know about. Typically, if there's an issue that I think he should be aware of, I would communicate with the chief of staff. It's most of my communications with the governor's office. As far as the communication back from the governor's office, it would either be to me through the chief of staff, or sometimes the director of department of management would be the two people that I would normally talk to on communications issues with the office.
I've been told I'm out of time.
Yeah. Chair calls on Representative Bodler to be followed by Senator McCoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. This blacklist or disqualification agreement, how far does that go back? Does that go back to 2000 or 2001, or help me out?
I know it goes back to 2011, because that's when I sat down in the chair in my office. As far as how much further back it goes than that, I don't know. Mr. Holman said he thought it was 20 years, but I have no idea. We could probably get that information for you to accurately.
Okay, you, if I understood you right, you're thinking it could go back 20 years.
But I don't know. I'm just saying there was a statement in the paper that went back that far. So I would have to find out who it been. I'd be glad to do that for you.
Okay, do you know offhand what section of law it is that this qualification is?
No.
Okay.
I know it's code, but I'd have to get those sections for you.
Okay. And I'm thinking of a situation, let's say somebody lost their job at a state institution for elder abuse, okay, and they have a disqualification agreement. My question is, if that person would go to another state, does this and apply for a job in the same type of a facility, et cetera, does that facility have access to our blacklist or disqualification?
No, they do not. That's strictly the state of Iowa disqualification.
So this abuser could go to another state and go right back into the same type of facility that he or she was in here and continue their practices, if you will.
It's even a little more dire than that, for lack of a better word.
Help me out.
They could go back to work in the state of Iowa doing that same thing, as long as it wasn't for the state.
So they could go back to let's say, a nursing home facility in rural Iowa.
That's correct.
And they don't have the access to this information?
No, they don't.
Do you think they should?
I think they absolutely should. Either with my parent or me in one of those facilities, and they were hiring people, I would certainly want to know that. And I think everybody has the right to know that. If you can't behave properly in a certain type of job, then you should get out of that job. That's my personal opinion.
Okay, out-of-state, private, and state facilities, should they have access to that information?
I think everybody should have access to that information if it's that type of a situation, yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator McCoy to be followed by Representative Feeney.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to direct my next questions to Mr. Woodley. Mr. Woodley, I have your latest admin chart, which is dated October 2014. And on the chart, we've now, through public information process, identified 12 positions on this chart that have been filled that were not posted.
Okay.
Can you explain to me what your process is for posting and hiring new positions within the department?
Can you indicate which of those 12 there are, sir, just so I'm certain we're speaking of the same situations?
Sure. We'll begin with your new communications director, Caleb Hunter. We could move over to Chief Resource Maximization Officer Paul Carlson. Michelle Mendenhall. Then I would go down to Lon Anderson, Rick Schnones, Kevin Bikley, Deb Kruger, Phil Milplot, Nick Miller, Dave Peterson, Evan Hagen, and Charlie Cross.
Senator, if I may, and forgive me for interrupting, but really, those aren't under Doug's purview, at least most of them aren't. That's mostly under my reporting structure. I mean, they report to other people, but Doug wouldn't know about.
Okay, I thought you weren't in on the hiring or interview.
I'm
trying to figure out what you are in on, Mr. Carroll,
yeah,
right now. I'm struggling.
Not quite a bit. I can't explain to you the process of whether positions are advertised, whether they're required to be advertised, and what positions are merit or merit exempt. That's all handled through human resources. So when we decide there's a position available, we have to put together what's called a position description questionnaire,
yep.
Which talks about all the duties with regard to that specific position. We then fill out a supervisory questionnaire that says, are they going to be supervising people? And our opinion as to whether those positions are merit exempt, or contract coverage. That goes to human resources. They review that and either agree with or disagree with whether that's right or wrong based on the administrative rules and all the contracts and, you know, a myriad of things that human resources look to, and come back to us and say they either approve or deny those positions as one type or the other. Once that comes back to us, we then decide whether we want to proceed that way. Or if we want to do something different, if we decide we want to proceed that way, then it is signed off by human resources, comes to my office, it's signed off by me, it's signed off by the immediate supervisor of that specific position, goes to Department of Management, it's signed off by them.
So that I'm clear, and I want to note that the human resource arm is under the Department of Administrative Services. There is an administrative rules section. It indicates that there are two positions, actually, besides yourself, that are actually appointed positions and that do not need to be posted, and that is, by administrative rule, that would be the COO position, the director position, and the GSE position. Beyond that, everything else has to be fair and equitable and posted.
That's an accurate, Senator.
All
positions are defined as at-will positions, and have been way before I got there.
Well, I have reason to believe these positions were not posted, and I believe these positions were not properly filled.
They may not have been.
And I'm very concerned about that, and I don't know why it's so hard to get to that very element of truth about these positions. Mr. Woodley, it's my understanding that you have close relationships with three of the positions that you filled to replace the seven laid off bureau chiefs. Is that correct?
I'm not certain which three individuals you're speaking to, Senator.
Well, I can get the names for you in just a moment. They were the three that were waiting across the hall from the employees that had trouble with the truth, according to some of our other legislators here today. Evan Hagen, you recognize him?
Yes, he was hired for the position.
And what was his, I ran out of time because the director took my time. Now I'm getting to the truth, and I thank you.
If it pleases the committee, I'd be more than happy to answer the senator's question.
Okay.
And I apologize for taking
that. Evan Hagen.
Yes, Evan Hagen was hired. And I did not have a relationship with Evan Hagen.
Brent Carr.
Brent Carr I worked with on a professional basis on my most recent position, which also involved construction, and he worked for a construction company.
Calvin Miller.
I did not have a relationship with Calvin Miller.
Is it fair to say that you had knowledge of these folks in terms of their professional backgrounds, and they were approached by folks with NDAS to apply for these jobs?
All individuals were approached by me, and then I reviewed their qualifications along with some other individuals that were interviewed and spoken to about the position, in addition to those three, as we were seeking the best talent possible to fill the role.
And it's also my understanding that these positions that these individuals had, they all had very similar backgrounds, years of experience and professional backgrounds, as to about the same as the employees laid off.
On paper, that's very true, yes, sir.
And I looked at their resumes, and the people you laid off were more qualified. I don't understand. And you paid these folks more.
The folks that we laid off were very qualified. As I spoke to earlier, we had a very, very tough assignment, and that is having a seamless transition with our construction portfolio statewide.
Seamless would mean that you would destructure the layoffs so that there could be a transition. We paid these folks for 20 days after we laid them off. Why couldn't they have stayed at their desks for 20 days and helped the new people get acquainted with the job? This makes absolutely no sense. I mean, to say seamless transition means that the new person has the time to work with the old person, and you know, as by your own admission, $430 million worth of open contracts in the state, and we just sent these people out the door. Anybody with any institutional or project knowledge, that to me was negligent.
Yes, sir. I respect your opinion on that. I will tell you that we thought of the process very carefully to have a.
I have real trouble with that answer, sir. I have real trouble with that. What occurred does not appear thoughtful. It appears thoughtless, and I'm out of time. But we're going to have another time. We're going to have another time real soon, and I want to deal with these issues of employment. We're going to need the human resource folks in here as well, because they're the folks that have allowed this hiring to occur without public notice and without posting and without following the rule of law or the rule of government. Thank you.
Sir, may I have the opportunity to answer the senator's question? It's very important.
It wasn't a question. It was a statement.
It's his final remark. It's time for me to, not final remark, end of time. I apologize. And we call on Representative Thede.
Thank you. I want to walk back through the 24. I think that's important because that's what this really comes down to. And, you know, when you were talking earlier, you could tell that this is bothersome to you. And so that shows me there is some concern for those employees. But I also want to say that if you feel that way, so do those 24 employees.
Absolutely.
And that's not a criticism, that's just saying there's that issue. But let's walk back through the 24 for just a moment. In your earlier statement, you said there were four that you specifically dealt with as part of those amendments.
There were four that I signed.
That you signed off.
That's correct.
Okay. So let's talk about those others that are left over. Now, according to you, there were others within that department that dealt with those others. Is that correct?
Those others were dealt with by a number of different entities. Some of them were dealt with by the Attorney General's office. Some of them were dealt with by the Public Employee Relations Board. And some of them were handled by labor relations specialists within DAS, because that's part of our charge by code to handle those things, and would have been approved for them to sign off by my office. Yes.
So
there's a number of different entities that were involved in these types of agreements.
So this would be difficult to determine what was agreed upon, what was said, and what was paid out, and what was used to get them out. Would that be fair?
I'm not sure I understood your question exactly. Would you mind?
Sure. Let me make it a little clearer. You're right. That was kind of confusing. Let me just say that because there were others who were involved who did this, you're not quite sure what took place with any of those employees. Would that be fair?
I wouldn't be necessarily familiar with all of the details of how they got to agreement now.
Okay. So, and I know we've used this word a lot, but I think it's worth kind of talking about, and that is, if there was secret money or hush money, unfortunately, you would have not have known that. Would that be fair?
I can tell you that for the agreements that I signed and for the agreements that our department was involved in, there would not have been hush money offered. No.
But to be fair, you wouldn't really know that, right?
I wouldn't know with regard to our department. I would not know with regard to the ones the Attorney General has to do with or the ones that the Public Employee Relations Board has to do with.
So, and I'm not trying to box you in. I don't want to do that. But I guess I want to be fair to say that the Attorney General Office or any other entity having to deal with these other people may deal other than what you are familiar with, or not familiar with.
Yes, that would be correct. If you're saying for settlement agreements that our department was not involved in, I would not have knowledge of the sorts of facts, that would be a correct statement.
So, with those folks that are left over, there is still questions about those people. And part of the process with the Oversight Committee is that that we have to investigate those that we feel, other than those four, we feel that we have to look at that and say, who did what? And it's my understanding you did ask about getting who did what with those. I mean, I think that information is important so that we know how to go forward because, and again, I don't mean to keep using this, if there was money, if there was hush money used or secret monies used, we need to know that. That's the part that we do need to know. Now, again, you don't know that, but I'm just saying it could be part of, I want us to be diligent and careful about how we do this. So my question would be, well, I have 29 questions, but I'll just stick to this point. I think that because what we don't know, this part becomes very very, very disconcerting because there are people out there who are not, well, unfortunately, and tell me if I'm wrong, are these 24 not hireable anymore?
No. I don't know whether any of these are disqualified or not, but the vast majority of them are probably eligible for state employment, but I'd have to look at the specific settlement agreements, and frankly, I'm not even sure from the face of the settlement agreement you can tell. You have to go into the human resources system and see how they were actually coded. That settlement agreements don't mean that you're disqualified from state employment.
Well, okay, because we don't know if they're, because I don't know if they're settlements or not. My request would be that we get that information that I asked about. Could we get that information?
For all 39 settlement agreements that are out there? Or just
for the 24,
so you don't worry, you're not worried about the other 13?
Well, I am worried about the other 13. Okay. We can do all 39, that's fine.
Okay.
I would like to see what all those look like. If we can get that information, I think that would be helpful.
Sure, okay. You can get that. And just to clarify, the four individuals that you talked to yesterday certainly aren't disqualified from state employment. None of them are disqualified from state employment. So I want to make sure you're clear that because we settled an agreement doesn't mean you're out forever. It's just a settlement of a specific grievance at that point in time.
Well, I don't want necessarily the four. I just want to know the others that I talked to.
Sure.
That's the ones that I'm talking about.
Sure. In fact, I think they'll all be posted, if I'm fairly soon, on the public website. I believe all of this latest administrations are on there. I believe that the prior to this administration, the Culver administration, I believe all those are posted. And I believe the Vilsack ones will be as soon as they're able to be redacted appropriately by the Attorney General's office. So you'll be able to get that information off of the website very, very soon.
Okay, and then this is just my last question. My other concern, and I'm not quite sure about the framing this, I'm just going to say the way I'm thinking and then you can kind of go from there. I think the other concern is that we have an air of secrecy that is difficult to comprehend. It's very difficult to comprehend. As we're trying to weed through all of this, and I know you're going to talk about the executive order, and we're going to get through that part of it. But the problem is, if we're dealing with what we're dealing with now, we have leftover problems with those employees who and we will see, who are not employable. Now these folks are without jobs. My concern is that moving forward, those folks are now without, they're not even, if this air, say this airs, these folks going out to find jobs now are not employable anywhere. Now, could be. I'm wondering how the state would do that, how you would do that, your office would do that.
Would you allow me to try and clarify to make sure I understand
sure.
what you're asking?
Are
you talking
we
are,
about? We are out of
okay.
time on this one.
Okay.
If you allow me to go on, we'll call on Senator Greiner, and then I believe we have no further House members. We'll then call on Representative Murphy and then Senator Garrett. We're moving. Come on. May I ask you to turn yours off?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, it turns off the microphones for other purposes too. So we're moving toward adjournment. I need to share with folks that we have a two-hour block, but there also is an appropriations meeting in here at 1. I'm aiming to protect approximately 3 minutes for the closing remarks that were referred to earlier to come by the director. And so I'm asking people to be briefer. And having done that, we next call on Senator Greiner.
Thank you, and I will be brief. Going back to the confidentiality clauses, we just can't seem to get away from that. We talked about curb assisting the negotiation process in some cases. And then somebody brought up Denny Holman's name, and suddenly a light bulb went off in my head. Did Denny Holman ever assist in negotiating any of these confidentiality clauses or signing off on any of them?
I can't speak to whether he was involved in the negotiations. I don't really have to ask him that question. I do know that there was one settlement agreement that had a confidentiality clause in it that had his signature on it, and I believe that was in the Culver administration. So I do know there was one. Other than that, I don't know anything.
Okay, thank you. And then I want to quickly move on to another line of questioning. And that was in reference to Senator McCoy's questions about people leaving the job site once they were notified that they had been terminated. You do have quite a bit of experience in the private sector, is that not true? And isn't it fairly common in the private sector when someone is terminated I've been in jobs where I've seen people actually escorted to the door, with nothing but their personal, per person, Isn't that fairly common when someone is terminated to end the employment immediately? We can have some pretty perturbed employees that could create quite a bit of havoc in 10 days, 2 weeks time if you kept them on. Isn't it fairly common in private industry?
Well, first of all, to be absolutely clear, none of these employees that we're talking about with the layoff were terminated. They were laid off. And by law, we have to give them 20 days notice that they're going to be laid off. It was a management decision that it was probably going to be uncomfortable for them, to say the least, and also could be disruptive to the ongoing operation to have them in the office. So we told them that they would be laid off in 20 days and that they did not need to report to the office but would be paid for those 20 days. So they were still employed and being paid for the 20 days that from the time we gave them notice until they were actually laid off. They were not terminated. I don't think, to my knowledge, I don't think they were escorted anywhere. I think they were given an opportunity to get their personal effects out of their work area and to take those with them. I don't think there was any hostilities on anybody's part that I'm aware of. So to me, it was just a management decision that it would probably be better for both the employee and for the organization that they just be at home for those 20 days.
Well, thank you for those comments. It sounds to me like it was handled relatively well, in that I've witnessed some situations where perhaps it wasn't handled quite as graciously as the way you did.
They're never easy.
That's right.
I'm sure it was very gracious.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And before we adjourn, I do want to make a motion here before the committee. But for you actually advocated for House File 2462. Have you read the bill?
Yes, I have.
You have in its entirety? You understand that it's not Executive Order 85?
Yes.
So you're still advocating for a bill even though it's not Executive Order 85?
Yes.
And you understand that it has the word demotion in there, and it's not defined within the Iowa Code?
I didn't know that it wasn't defined within the Iowa Code. I know the word demotion is in the bill, yes.
Okay, well, I guess the question
Point
I have is... Yeah.
Demotion is defined in administrative rule under death.
But it's not defined in the Iowa Code, and it's not defined for the purposes of that bill, which was part of the discussion we had last night, along with numerous other actions. So, the bottom line is I was going to ask him, what's your definition then of a demotion? We had arguments. Lateral changes can be considered demotion, but I think the big one everybody argues is whether or not it involves pay. If a person suffers even a $5 drop in pay in a year, it could be viewed as a demotion. How does DAS review something and look at it as a demotion?
A demotion would be a change in classification due to either disciplinary reasons, pay scale due to disciplinary reasons, or a voluntary demotion in order to remain employed because your position was no longer available and there was another position available within state government that you voluntarily decided you would take with a demotion.
Good. So you could actually take a job increase, but because it drops a grade, you may be taking a demotion, even though technically it might be a promotion.
You say that again?
If you took a job classification, but because it was new to you, and they gave it, but they started you out at a lower pay grade, even though in the end you might be able to make more, it still could be viewed as a demotion, correct?
I don't know. Specifically, I have to ask the HR professionals on that.
I mean, it's specified 11 times in the Iowa Code that we checked last night. There's no, there is no definition within the Iowa Code of what a demotion is, yet we have a bill that's promoting that is even being said that it's Executive Order 85, when in actuality it's not.
That I don't, I'm not a legislator or an attorney, so I couldn't answer that for sure.
Well, that's
I read the bill. I read the bill, and I agree with the intent of the bill, and that it would be a good idea to do that.
Okay. And I do want to look at, because portions of that bill are not, so you're saying you actually support the Executive Order 85 and also support the bill, even though they contradict each other at times.
I support Executive Order 85 because we have no law. If you can pass a law that does what the intent of this law is, as I understand it,
but
I would support the law and the executive order would no longer be needed.
But wouldn't you agree that we still got the disclosure we need because all they had to do was FOIA the request and they found out about the hush money and the secret settlements?
There was no hush money, there were no secret settlements because all they had to do was a FOIA.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, no, I don't believe they could go as far as they needed to for the very reasons, the issues we've talked about here. That FOIA request told them nothing about why that particular employee might have been disciplined or terminated, and as a result, no one outside of the HR department that has the personnel record would ever know why, what those reasons were.
And you think
that's problematic? Yeah, that is very problematic to me for the reasons I discussed.
Because as I say, you worked in the private sector, I've worked in the private sector, there's certain things that in human resource records are never discussed, and they're not even disclosed when you go out and look for another employee. For other employment, if you leave that employment, because it's considered confidential information that is between the employer and the employee, and you're saying here that there are issues that you're concerned about on an HR perspective that we shouldn't have.
I don't know how that information is kept confidential on the private side, unless someone signs a confidentiality agreement to keep them from disseminating that information.
Right.
Yeah.
But the other part, too, is there is a liability for libel or for slander or defamation if an employer in the private sector puts it out. Even if the person signs it, they have to sign a disclosure from the person they're seeking employment from to get that access to their record. Here we go to the meeting.
There's a myriad of things that could happen.
Right.
But as far as I know, if there's an employee action in the private side that doesn't have a confidentiality agreement signed with their dismissal, they can tell anybody what that employee did and why they dismissed it.
Right.
Okay. So it takes a confidentiality agreement to keep that separate, secret. That concerns me with state government because we're a public entity. We're not a private entity. And we're sending people out to other governments, to the private side, without any ability to tell them what that individual may have as a shortfall within their particular type of job.
So you're saying that even though it might have been the employer's responsibility of an overreaction on a discipline area, that you think that should still be part of the discussion, even if the accusations were
there's a through. Complete grievance process that all goes through so that can be determined. Yes. If the complete grievance cycle has been completed, that's been determined outside of the purview of either management or employee. That's why it's there. Yes, sir.
I apologize for the interruption. We've reached time, and I need to do two apologies. Senator Garrett, we don't have time for your questions. I apologize for that as well, because we intended to give Director Carroll 3 minutes. I'm going to do two things as we move toward adjournment. One is ask the director to do his closing remarks in 1 minute.
You do that.
Prior to that, I'd like to call on Chair Peterson for a question regarding the public information request that she has placed previously in writing.
Thank you. I had made a request on March 27th for a number of items to help the Oversight Committee get a better understanding, including things such as the layoff documents that were provided to the former state employees, job descriptions of the new employees at DAS, the job posting of those positions, the documents you prepared for the governor's office as he was trying to conduct his own investigation. Now, I hear you're going back through 45 boxes of materials from years ago, and we have yet to receive the material we need for governing now. I want to know where you are in the process in getting our committee the information we've requested.
I believe that was a request through the governor's office, if I remember correctly. And I can't tell you exactly where we are in getting that all together. There's a lot of material there. We're working as diligently as we can to get that together and back to that.
Well, I know some of the materials we've requested you've had to have already compiled. So if you would get it to us as it is ready, we would appreciate it. I mean, certainly asking for the materials that the governor's office was able to review for their investigation, that's not too much to ask. Job descriptions, all of those things, those should be easy and readily available. So we would expect those soon.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you for that, Director Carroll. And we don't have a 4 minutes, but take
I'll
a minute.
I'll hurry.
Thank you.
In summary and conclusion, I made a mistake in allowing the confidentiality clauses to be included in these agreements if they did not comply with the governor's transparency initiative. The governor, through Executive Order 85, has led this administration to state a more transparent government. The governor and lieutenant governor knew nothing of the terms or conditions within these settlement agreements. The agreements were not secret, but a matter of public record. The payments made were made out of operating budgets because they did not qualify for payment out of the general fund through the appeal board. The payments made were not hush money, but settlement of specific grievances as evidenced on their face. The reorganizational changes made in design and construction resulted in an operational savings of $730,000 per year, plus a potential of over $12 million more in reduction of claims to Iowa taxpayers. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to answer your questions and to clarify the facts surrounding this issue. I look forward to working closely with you and the governor in changing the law through House File 2462 to improve transparency in state government and in continuing to reduce the cost and improve the quality of state government for the taxpayers of this great state. Thank you very much.
On behalf of the entire committee and the state of Iowa, we appreciate your preparation and your candor and honesty today in answering many, many questions for 2 hours.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you, Director Carroll.
I second.
Representative Pesadel moves to rise. We are adjourned.
Yes.